Welcome to Our Thoughts Tonight. Join us as we chat in a mellow mood about music, philosophy, psychology, and anything else that will come to mind. Enjoy!
Our Thoughts Tonight.
Hello, everybody.
Ushik is here.
Hello.
Zach is here.
Yep.
And I am Alex Trebek, your host.
Alex Trebek, may I have Hyperreality for 800?
Double Jeopardy. Hyperreality Part 2. This time we're going to be bringing in the Gabby Petito, I believe is the name, case. We're going to talk about how the media and how that relates to Hyperreality and Baudrillard and interesting concepts of our current world. Also, remember to follow us on Twitter, at Krucem Sanctam. That'll be in our description. Usha, could you give a brief explanation of what hyperreality is for those who might not know?
All right, so hyperreality. So just as a refresher, if not, just watch the first episode. It's basically starts as a process of simulation where reality is in some way simulated. So that starts out with, at first you may think, you know, like the commodity, for example, like, oh, this commodity is something, right? And then you start replicating that and you have this whole basically hyper-real situation where the commodity now starts losing its value. Eventually, you get the situations like we were talking about in the episode where you have, like, I don't know, a sports drink, which is supposed to, you know, simulate this flavor, but it's really not that flavor.
Or the Christmas tree that's made of plastic that looks better than any actual Christmas tree could ever look.
Yeah, or also, like, and I think I mentioned this last episode, where, like, how even our emotions start to be, I suppose, activated by things that really shouldn't activate our emotions, like video games start to make us angry, even though that really shouldn't be the case because it's a fucking machine, you know? Yeah. So this eventually, this is our hyper-real situation, right? So where we're in not a real reality anymore.
How's your guys' day going so far?
What you talking about, Beach?
Before we get started, how's everybody doing?
Pretty good. I almost got bit by a chihuahua.
Chihuahua almost bit Zach.
Yeah.
How about you, Ushik?
I'm good. I think I have decided for a topic for one of my research projects. I will be doing the German throne dispute. Or I'm going to try to between the Hohenstaufens and the Welfs.
Wow.
So yeah.
That's deep.
It's cool, I guess. It's about this whole dispute between German emperors. It's really cool.
What years?
1195 to 1212, I think, something like that. It's basically like, it's actually a really funny story. It's genuinely like a Game of Thrones story where it's like this guy dies and then like the heir is taken away and it's like, oh, these two guys and one dies and blah 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 blah. Super interesting. Has a lot of papal influence going on too. So
interesting.
Cue the Game of Thrones music.
Yeah, it's really called the German Thrones dispute, which is hilarious. Yeah.
I love Game of Thrones.
Yeah.
Winter is coming.
It's crazy how we can look back that far and see that these things happened, even though, you know, we can't actually see it.
Right.
Now, you know, with the hyper reality of the internet. You know, 1,000 years from now, will people be looking back? Will people be listening back to podcasts that were, you know, 1,000 years old?
Well, I think Baudrillard would...
That's crazy to think about.
Yeah.
I mean, weird...
I guarantee you they will.
Yeah.
You know, people might be listening to this 1,000 years from now.
But see, that's what Baudrillard
Philosophers on fucking podcasts.
What would he say?
Well, he would be like... I mean, I think he actually mentions this in the book where it's like, we even look at history in hyper-real eyes because we're not there in history. We're viewing it off, like, you know, documents or secondary documents or... lectures or something
or
like
teachers.
That, where these events are actually more rooted in how we perceive them instead of what they actually were. So like I read the German Thrones dispute, it's coming off like a story off Wikipedia. I'm basically reading a book. I don't care if this is real.
Yeah,
the information's cool.
Yeah,
right.
Yeah,
but
if you're not in the shit,
yeah,
how
se.
Accurate is that? Yeah, exactly. Depiction
that
too.
It's like a third person perspective.
Right. I mean, for example, like there's not a lot of there's some documents on this event in history, but like. Overall, they're all biased to a certain extent. Or even if they're not biased, it's rooted in some way in the culture of that time.
Driven in their own narrative.
Right. So it's nothing is really pinpointed, you know, exactly, you know, as where it should be. So.
All right. Yeah. So.
Before we get into it, yeah.
Before we get into it, as always.
Crucem Sanctum.
Our Thoughts Tonight.
We are back.
Mm-hmm.
So, on the break, if you guys...
Literally on the break.
Yeah, literally on the break. So, let's just get some context first. About last year, maybe a year and 2 months ago, whatever,
yeah.
We contacted Noam Chomsky, actually, to possibly get an interview, but he was too busy. So, we recently emailed him, and just during the break, he responded to us. And he says he's too busy again, but there might be hopes for early next year, so... If you're listening to this, stay in tune because we may or may not interview Noam Chomsky.
He may reply during the show.
Most likely he will reply to us during the show right now. Guy is so good at replying, better than professors. Holy crap.
I wonder if it's an automated reply system.
I don't know. Because
it sounds really similar to the... To the email that he sent us last
year. He's got that copy and paste control.
I mean, like, the thing is, he probably has to say the same thing over and over again to, like, 70 people. Like,
yeah.
Or he might have people responding for him.
He said it on an interview, that interview that you sent us. Like, he said it at the end of that interview.
He did. Yeah, it did. That's why I thought. I was like, we should definitely ask him, because he seems pretty honest about that, you know?
Yeah.
He's a busy guy, man.
Yeah, I mean, like, yeah, at the end of the day, he's just...
Time is money.
Yeah, what was that?
Time is money.
Yeah, I get it.
The guy probably, you know, he's got a lot to do.
Yeah, he's trying to make sure his legacy is is out there, you know, and his legacy really has to do with... I think at this point, in every interview I've seen, he brings up climate change and nuclear war.
Mm-hmm.
I think that's what he wants to be seen as really... He wants to be seen as forward-thinking for the youth, obviously. That's right. Why he keeps bringing that up, and I think that's important. Because people our age don't talk about it nearly enough. Because we're caught up in our hyper-realities.
Yeah.
Yep.
Oh, I feel like, though, really quickly, I feel like... Because we would want to mention at least a little bit of, like... You know, psychology and language and stuff like that, because that's what he really is known for, or at least what he started out being known for.
I've always wanted to ask him, because I haven't been able to see, and maybe I haven't read enough, but I've always wanted to ask him what he thought about B.F. Skinner outside of, you know, their debate. Because Skinner, around the time, like, Skinner was older than Chomsky, and Skinner was doing similar things when he was like Chomsky's age in the 90s. I think he was getting old and he was still like fighting for humanitarian causes and stuff like that. Not as actively as Chomsky because, you know, he didn't have the internet. But I want to see what he thought about him as an academic aside from, or just as a person, as a thinker, aside from their debate. Because I know he disagreed with him on a lot.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, it's, you know, the whole split between, you know, ideas academically and like their person, you know, what he thinks of him personally or whatever. That'd be interesting. And the thing is, I feel like most of the interviews or whatever talks with Chomsky don't really delve into those things. Mm-hmm. It's always about politics. And that's fine. You know, that's what he cares about. So we should talk about politics with him. But it's also like, you know, I'm sure he would be interested in talking about stuff like that.
Because
even nowadays, everyone calls on Chomsky to talk about, like, what's your opinion on this political issue, Mr. Chomsky? You know, even though you're known as, like, the guy known for, you know, your cognitive psychology and your linguistics, you know? So it'd be good to, like, you know, show that we don't just care about him just because he has, you know, some good political ideas. He also has a lot of other stuff going on.
Great mind.
Yeah, I recently listened to something that he was saying about linguistics, where a lot of people think that language is used, or its purpose is for reference.
Frege.
And, you know, he doesn't believe that there is actually a intrinsic reference component built into language, that's not what it's for. It's actually its own thing. We just use it for reference. Mm-hmm. Something along those lines is simplified, and probably that's probably not correct, but something along those lines.
I actually need to get more into, like, Chomsky's linguistics, because I actually am, like, getting more into Frege, which was the guy who really got that sense reference thing going on.
Mm-hmm.
And I use it a lot in, like, the paper I'm working on. It's good stuff. And then Quinn's also really good with stuff like that. And Chomsky's influenced by Quinn. But I actually don't know what the specificities of his stuff with language too much. I know his general remarks, but, like, what he actually talks about reference, I'm not sure. That'd be good to talk with him.
Definitely.
Yeah. Also, actually, I wonder, man, I would love to actually ask him about Meinong, because he's a controversial philosopher who delves into linguistics a little bit, and I actually like him a little bit, so I wonder how what Chomsky would think of him.
You brought this guy up a few weeks ago, didn't you?
Yeah, I'm getting a lot into him. Like, he had a big dispute with Bertrand Russell, and he based off, it's more than linguistics. He's mostly based talks about like objects, and the thing that he's known for and the thing that's really controversial is something called Meinungsjungle, where according to him, any and all possibilities of objects sort of subsist, and a lot of philosophers have responded saying, well, what are you talking about? Like, where is all these things? You know, where's all these possibilities, you know, and linguistically? And he's like, they don't really exist. Or like, they more like absist and whatever. So it's very controversial. I want to see, you know, if Chomsky would know or have an opinion on him or whatever. But either way, let's hope he responds, you know.
Yeah.
I want to ask Chomsky about Trump and his thoughts on Trump.
I remember hearing a few things about that. And he has said, you know, it's the most dangerous group of people in office ever and things like that, you know. So I mean, obviously not good.
I mean, he low-key predicted Trump before Trump. There's that like famous interview where he's like, what did he say? He's like, oh man, he basically predicts that some sort of Trump figure where like, oh, you know, the real danger, the quote-unquote Nazis of America are going to be wrapped in American flags and are going to consider themselves patriots or something like that. Mm-hmm. And he's like, oh, you get a leader who's charismatic, blah blah blah, people get riled up, that's going to be our doom. And he's like, I wouldn't be surprised that comes in a few years later Trump comes. Yeah. Like he predicted Trump to a certain extent.
He also says something along the lines of like, this was around 2015 when Trump had said that he was going to run. He was saying things like, well, if you look at all the other candidates, he's not much more different than any of those other candidates.
He's just more well known.
He's more well known, and he's more willing to say the things that the other people believe too, but they're not willing to openly say because they're afraid it won't work for them.
Yeah,
it did work for Trump, but I'm not sure at the time if that would have worked for anybody else but Trump, because he already had the foundation through, you know, The Apprentice and his brand.
I think it would have worked for Chris Christie, because I don't know, during the debates, Chris Christie was like Trump light, where he was also kind of like, you know, kind of in your face, not as much. There's that very famous scene, you know, Crapper Reality, the debates were very much like spectacle shows.
Oh, very much.
But where Chris Christie's like trashing Marco Rubio for sounding like a robot, and he's like super in his face. He's like, he's doing it again, blah, 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 blah. So he's basically being like the Trump of that debate. And another guy that I used to watch back then, Secretary Talk, he was like, if Trump didn't run, Chris Christie would have won.
You think so?
I mean, I don't know if I'd think so, but like, he was definitely like a Trump light, where he wasn't as bombacious as Trump, but he was still like,
yeah,
you know, kind of in your face. And then he turned and supported Trump, and he was seen as like, you know, that like the bitch boy.
Like, Trump was good though. I mean, I just saw a snippet of one of those debates from back in 2015, 2016. No, it was 2016. The debates were going on because the election was in 2016.
Yeah,
so, probably late 2015 too, though.
But yeah,
16 mostly.
Anyway, so yeah, I mean, he was good in terms of not necessarily actually debating, but he was really good at trashing everybody else on there. He was faster, and he had like these comebacks where they were almost like, you know, things that you're supposed to do that are like
psychological warfare.
Yeah, they're like psychological warfare where they're methods to kind of inoculate somebody's argument. Like if somebody calls you stupid,
yeah,
you take that statement and it's like reductio absurdum. You're like, yeah, I'm so stupid. Yeah. Look at me. Like it would just bounce off of him.
Right.
Yeah.
And in that sense, Hillary, I don't know whether he was actively doing that or not, but he was doing shit like that. And that's why he won.
Yeah. Because
he was fast.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. I mean, again, like if Trump's good at anything, it's his words. I mean, and that's a weird way to say that, because he's not good with his words, but he's good in a different way.
Billions and billions and billions.
A lot of the criticisms he had were legit in some sense. God, I sound like a total Trumper here, but like criticizing the media, good. Criticizing establishment politicians, you know, good, because they're not what they should be.
But it's so surface level, because like at the end of the day, he was the establishment.
Yeah. You know? Exactly. Yeah, he was just using, you know, a different form of platitudes to get these points across.
I remember during that, there was talks about like Earlier on in the 2016 election, it was like, who's the outside candidate, Bernie or Trump, right? I remember right-wingers saying, Bernie's already admitted he would support Hillary Clinton if she won, so he's really the inside candidate. Trump's actually the outside candidate. Well, Trump won, and guess what? He was really the inside candidate. You know, I mean, so was Hillary, but like, I mean, it was just a bunch of lies. But that's what I usually say, though, is like, if you supported Trump in 2016, I don't really hate you. You know, you got fooled, and that's fine. Like, so many people did. If you supported Trump in 2020, that's a whole different story. You know, if you didn't, like, and there's some people who didn't support him in 2016, but support him in 2020, and that's insane. Like, oh, he did great on the economy. Like, get the fuck out of here. Like, all these things.
No way.
And that's what they always go to, though. It's like, oh, he did good on the economy. Like, are you serious? Like,
yeah, sure. Oh, my gosh.
It's absolutely insane. Well,
most people that say that know nothing about economics.
Yeah, exactly. And also, like, I mean, there's, like, so many interviews out there, or, like, quote-unquote interviews where, like, they go to Trump supporters, like, oh, what was your favorite thing that Trump did? It's like, they can't name a single thing that Trump did. Like, yeah. What, tax cuts that didn't affect you? Like,
cut taxes for who? The yeah. Corporations.
Right. It's like, you can't excuse Trump's administration. You can excuse him maybe during, the 2016 election, but, like, even then.
Yeah.
Right.
The ban on Muslims.
Oh, okay. Come on. You know,
some people would see that as a good thing.
Building
which
the
is
wall
awful.
In Mexico.
They built the wall. Yeah.
I mean, again,
for Mexicans.
In all ineffective
it.
Things.
Yeah. Though. I mean, and then his COVID response, like, God damn, like, you just can't get past that.
That's bad. I mean, like, what
that's
response?
The end of
what response, really?
Yeah.
They didn't do shit.
It's like hypocritical shit, you right. know, like 2 months prior. We're going to build a wall in Mexico, but we're not going to build it. The Mexicans are going to build it. And then it's like Cinco de Mayo. And he's like, oh, the best fucking taco salads at Trump Tower. Yeah. I'm like, how more contradictory can you be? Like, what is this?
And how, like, it's low-key, like, insulting.
Yeah, I know. It's, yeah. It's like a backhand to the face.
Yeah.
You know?
I mean, the only thing of Trump that I think you can somewhat, I don't even know if I should give him credit for this, but, like, the whole thing with, like, North Korea was, it wasn't really his efforts that really helped to do progress in North Korea. It was really the South Korean leader. He was really the one that really paved the way for, like, some sort of cooperation mm-hmm. with North Korea. Did Trump play a role in that? Maybe. Maybe his aggressiveness was
I think he
helpful.
Was forward enough.
Yeah, I think
that's all falling apart now, too.
Right, right. So it's like, you know. But if anything, maybe that. But, like, even that's, like, not really his thing. I mean, you just can't excuse the guy. Mm-hmm. There's no way. And, you know, and then, you know, to tie back to today's topic, he really did, you know, this hyper-real situation really has gone out of hand under him.
Well,
you know?
What Zach was saying was right on point, where his contradictory points.
Yeah.
A lot of people are, and I'm wondering too, and I don't think we'll ever know, like, he would say one thing, mm-hmm. and then he'll say another thing about that thing he said, and then everyone would call him out on that, uh-huh. and then he would be like, no, I didn't say that. And
then they bring up a fucking clip of what he said before, and then he's like,
yeah, whoa. He'll still deny it.
I mean, for God's sakes, there was that whole clip where, like, there was a recording of him,
rant.
And he's like, that's not me.
Yeah.
Remember
yeah.
that?
Yeah. Like, I don't remember that one, but I would not doubt it.
Well, it wasn't during his the recording wasn't during his time as president, it was like years before or something. And then he was like, that's not me, that was someone else that's impersonating my voice.
I'm saying,
are you serious?
And then he'll go off on a rant about how the media is corrupt.
You know, yeah.
Yeah, yeah. That,
you know, he's like, oh,
exactly.
Just,
blame it on the media.
You're just using people with my voice
yeah.
to do that.
But that's so dangerous. Like,
it is dangerous.
When you have a valid point in criticizing the media, but you're not the one to say it, but you have a valid point, like, that's such trickery. That's so evil. Like, you make your good points. You get the people all along your way because you're making the right points. And then you, like, they're so in your bubble that you just, and then you just take them off in, like, Neverland.
Yeah,
you know,
exactly.
It's
and this is kind of what's happened,
into
though.
Into hyper reality.
This is kind of what's happened because Putin did this. He'll say one thing and then he'll do another thing.
Right.
And then, like, they say they'll support one group of people and then they go support the opposition of that
right.
group. And it's all a psyop mm-hmm. to control and disorient mm-hmm. Ideological subversion.
I mean, and tying back to hyper reality, what matters is not what actually happens, it's what's presented.
Exactly.
And what's presented is what the leader is saying. Like, why would you watch or why would you research blah, 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 what Putin did or Trump did instead of just, oh, you know, oh, they said this, so they must support, you know, whoever, or they
you,
must
you
do
can
this.
Simplify it.
You think, yeah.
You could be like, yeah, I'll be at work at 4 p.m. and I'm going to do my job and then just like not show up at 4 p.m. And then, but you show up the next day and they're like, where were you? And I'm like, what are you talking about? I was here. It's essentially the same thing on a smaller scale.
Right.
You know?
Yeah.
It's all about sound bites too. And with the media, it's like, that is the only lens we get to this world. Nowhere else are you going to see any of this. Mm-hmm. The general public do not look at data of mm-hmm. what happens and what goes on mm-hmm. in terms of like legislation and all of that, because that is a lot of jargon and a lot of runaround, and you know, they don't really make it that accessible. Like, it's not popping up on your news feed on Instagram what laws passed this week or this month. And then the media, since it is the only lens, people just don't question it. And it's like, I was just reading about this on one of my social psychology textbooks, and there are a handful of reasons as to why people don't actually read into the manipulation of media and why they do. Mm-hmm. One of the main factors is that they think that it won't affect them. And I think that everybody is guilty of that to a certain extent, because we feel now in this state of the world like that is just covered with different ways of simulations or different forms of simulations that we feel like we're just watching everything happen and it won't affect us because of, you know,
just like coronavirus.
We literally are watching, you know,
just like coronavirus. We're like, oh, it's in China.
Yeah,
I'm in Alaska.
Exactly.
It's not going to hit me.
React.
I mean, that was
it's not going to affect me.
I mean, that was what a lot of people would say. It was like, oh, do you even know what people with COVID?
Fucking fast forward 2 years now, and like Alaska's got like some of the highest cases.
It is the highest.
It's like, right now.
In ratios,
like, at least. In the last 3 days, there's been like over 1,000 cases the last three days.
Yeah. Highest
I think today was like 1,700 or something like that. Same. The day before was like 15. And then the day before that, I don't know if this is... I know it's over 1,000.
Right, right.
And the day before that, it was like 1,245 or something.
I mean, just the other day, I wasn't feeling good. I got tested. I wasn't.
You know what I mean?
It's a lot.
Yeah.
For
3 days.
Per 100,000, I think there's like, it's rising. I mean, it's still not.
But 2 years ago, we're like, oh, okay. It like, there's a thing going
on
in China.
Nobody thought it was going
to
affect anybody.
It's not going to hit us. And it's like, oh, a cruise ship. And then from that cruise ship, and then
that's also another. What I thought at that time was, like, you've seen Ebola, you've seen all these like different random strains of viruses come up in the media, and they've made it a big deal then for like a week or two, and just like any other passing news story, I thought this was the same thing. When I saw that, and I was like, yeah.
It's like you don't really pay attention until you see a cause and effect.
Exactly. Mm-hmm.
And in your forefront, like right in front of your eyes, you know.
When people started actually getting it in the States.
Wearing masks and everyone's talking about it. And next thing you know, everything's shut down. Yeah. And then we're like, what am I going to do with my life? Right. I got to twiddle my thumbs.
A people mover was driving by me last night as I was driving home. And I saw, like, you know how they have the lights on the front of it?
Yeah.
People movers, public bus here. And it said on the LED lights in the front of the bus, masks required.
Yeah.
And it just like every few months I like stop and realize like what reality we're living in. And that was one of those moments I was like, God damn it. I can't believe this is. And I'm more than willing to wear a mask and everything, but I was like, I can't believe this is still going on.
It's the norm surreal. Now. It's really the norm now.
That's what's surreal about it is like it has become the norm now.
Yeah.
Like we've succumbed to it. Mm-hmm. Like we're used to it now. But it's like it's those signs, like you just pointed out, where it's just a brief second, you know. Mm-hmm. Or you'll just like look around. You're like, damn, everyone's wearing a fucking mask. Yeah. And you know what I mean? It's just like simplistic things. Or you're like, wow, this is life now.
It's you know? Weird.
It's the new norm.
I will say this crazy. Though. I will say this. I feel like there was a lull a few months ago. And I feel like people got comfortable. And even I was like, you know, no one started wearing masks. And it was like people were kind of getting back to normal. And the whole Delta stuff came in. And like, because it was like a moment where everyone was starting to get vaccinated, everything was okay, and people even to this day I feel like we still feel
people
like
are
that.
Fucking naive,
but it's
dude.
Not yeah,
and I'm guilty of it. I am naive
me too.
Luckily, you know, I haven't I haven't contracted coronavirus once. And right. for me, I feel like that's crazy.
Yeah.
Considering like my habits and the type of person I am, and I go out and I do things, and you know,
yeah, no, tell me about it. Like I go to fucking school, like yeah, that's what I'm in saying, person. You know,
we might have had it. Now that we're vaccinated, we might be asymptomatic.
Yeah,
but that would mean we wouldn't have to get tested.
I think that I had it before it was announced here in the U.S.
Really?
So when I was reading it on the news, I went to a hospital because I had shortness of breath and I was coughing up like blood and phlegm and shit.
Right.
And I thought I had pneumonia. So I went to the hospital or one of those like fucking strip mall doctors or whatever. Uh-huh. I went there. Yeah. They're like, oh, you just got
retail clinic.
Yeah. They were like, oh, you just got a cough. And then basically told me what I already knew. I shelled out $525 just to fucking hear whatever they told me. And then they're like, oh, just go get like Tylenol. And I'm like, cool. Right. Fast forward 4 months. And then it's like coronavirus on the urge. Everyone's got it. Got to wear a face mask. Like we're to stay indoor for a month. You know what I mean? And then I got vaccinated shortly after. But I haven't tested positive for coronavirus.
Mm-hmm.
And like I wear masks where I have to. I'm not like an anti-masker or whatever. But I just think it's very, very strange. And same thing with my girlfriend, too. She hasn't tested positive for COVID either,
right?
You know, so yeah. I feel like there's a large sum of people that are just like, if you've had it like early on or something like that, I don't know if I have or not, your body will fight, your immune system will fight it away faster. Whether if you never had it, got the vaccine, maybe. And like I'm still gonna go get the booster shot. I'm not saying like I'm fucking immune or anything, but. You know, I'm like cautious. Delta, yeah, exactly. You know,
yeah, it's scary. It's. I mean, I
talk about hyper reality.
Yeah, I mean, I haven't been tested positive either, but I did do a test last week and I was negative. Now I was like surprised. I actually low key thought I had it.
That's what I'm saying.
Right,
like, you get all skeptical in your own brain. You're like, oh, I coughed once.
Yeah.
You know, like you could eat a salad with pepper.
Yeah,
and like. That's the thing too. Oh, it's not just with us. It's like,
thanks.
But you know what I mean? Like, it's like people that are around us. A cough nowadays, like a cough used to be a normal thing.
Next break, all of a sudden.
If one person coughs in a room full of fucking like 20 people, I bet you if that guy coughs loud enough and everyone hears it, everyone's neck breaks.
See,
stares at him for like 5 seconds. It's just out of like knowing that there's a virus out there.
So the thing about what you're mentioning though, Zach, with the whole coughing thing and what it represents, that might, so I keep moving this, that might in a way connect with hyper reality is, or even just like representation and reference and stuff. Like normal things have other connotations that go with them now. Coughing is not a connotation that, oh, that guy is just coughing. Oh, he has a cold.
That guy has
COVID.
Yeah, you know, like, exactly. Because of media and because of all the things that are going on in the world, we're all protective of ourselves and people that we care about. So when you got one guy coughing now, fucking 20 necks are gonna break staring at the guy.
Right.
Like, does he got the vid?
Seriously,
like, we don't know.
But that's what you
will we ever know?
But it sucks because like that's what you're supposed to do in a weird way.
It's like one of those sitcoms that ends on a fucking black screen. You gotta wait another year for the next season to come out. You know what I mean? It's like that, but we don't know the answers. But still, as humans, we hear something like that because of what we've been fed as a society, and we break our necks and stare at the guy regardless.
But
it's like conditioning to a certain extent.
100%.
Yeah.
I mean, yeah.
And I was just going to say, like, this goes on to a whole thing which we connect with the rest of hyper reality is, like, what do things really represent anymore? Because, like, for example, it's completely unrelated to COVID, but, like, for example, there's a new, like, trend going on. Like, I watched a video like recently about this dark aesthetics. I don't know if you guys know about that kind of stuff. I don't know. It's
vaguely.
It's like, a bunch of like,
is it like the dark academia stuff?
That's what it was. Dark academia. Not aesthetics, but it is aesthetics. But yeah, it's dark academia. It's like, it's people, like usually teenagers or like young adults, like who just like dress up as dark academia to present a facade of, you know, academia. Mm-hmm. Oh, and whatever. And it's, and
are
that's
they not
modern
actually
day
academia?
Or they don't have to be.
Yeah.
You don't go to college. Guess what? You wear some nice clothes, read some Nietzsche. I'm dark academia.
It's a style.
It's aesthetics. So like, but this is what I'm talking about. It's like, it this whole idea of representation goes hands in with anything. And like the topic that you want to talk to about today, I forgot her name.
Gabby Petito.
Gabby, so it's like the whole idea of, like, for example, about, you know, kidnappings or extending it to, like, you know, shootings and stuff like that. Like, oh, what's being presented is, you know, killings in Chicago, like, constantly, for example, right? And it's supposed to represent, oh man, there's actually this going on so much, you know, the proportions are insane. Chicago's insane. It's a war zone, black and black violence. It's like, but that's just a false reference. Mm-hmm. It's just a representation that goes with everything from COVID stuff to dark academia. It's just like false representation. And that's what hyper reality really is. It's false representations.
The same goes for, I mean, that was happening through the 90s, even though from the 90s on until, now, currently, crime has been decreasing significantly.
Right. Yeah.
And another thing is mass shooters, or not mass shooters, because mass shootings are now considered four or more within a few hours with, you know, there's another stipulation there, but I can't remember exactly what it is. But let's say not mass shooters, but active shooter events, like where somebody barges into like a movie theater or something, like the Aurora shooting. Mm-hmm. Those are represented in the media as a significant wave of events that seems to happen mm-hmm. on a seemingly daily basis is what when it happens, that's how they cover it, right?
Right.
And then from that point on, they immediately go into gun laws, and then the contradictory argument there would be, you know, anti-gun laws. Mm-hmm. And then the media will start to look for reasons as to why the shooter did do whatever it was that he was going to do. Whatever it was that he did do. I have the statistics here in my computer, but forensics has found very little evidence for most of active shooters from 2000 to 2018, I believe, that had mental, issue. Personality disorders,
mental illness.
So there haven't been very many signs of actual mental illness
That's
or
crazy.
Personality disorder. Yet that is what they blame it on, time and time again.
Yeah,
the FBI actually has a checklist of ways you can, you know, spot these people out ahead of time, like antecedent behaviors to look out for, and a lot of these people actually have other reasons that have more of a societal impact. Like, these people did it because of society, not an internal drive to just want to kill, like psychopathy or something. But like, what's his name, for instance, Stephen Paddock, the Las Vegas shooter, he had no record. He had one traffic violation.
Right.
I mean, the guy was totally boring. He was like on a trust fund, essentially just going from cruise to cruise and gambling, just an old retiree. And you can't point to anything that is personality related with that.
Right. And I noticed like a breakdown in their life. Like they've hit a wall and they're like, I got nothing to lose. I'm going to kill
people. Exactly. And then society impacts them in a way that, you know, stress that adds a stressor. And then they see this as something that they want to.
I mean,
they're clearly projecting some sort of aggression onto a body of society.
It's like a fucking kid that throws a tantrum, but as an adult waving a gun, you know?
Yeah.
100%.
I mean, like,
it's like, I didn't get my way. Fuck everybody. I'm going to kill you. There's nothing you can do or say about it until afterwards.
Yeah.
After I've already painted my painting.
I don't know the statistics on this, but like, so to start off with, it's like, one, the right loves to go to the mental health part, which, you know, because they're like, you know, oh, well, let's not do anything with like gun laws. It's just the mental health.
Yeah, suddenly they become very,
like, very pro health.
Pro health and pro mental health.
Even though half of them don't believe in therapy, but like, okay, so you have that development going on, and then you have these other reasons for why the person might shoot. And I don't know what the statistics are on this, but like, to a certain extent, from what I understand, it's like it's either going to be like societal influences, right? So you do have a very direct correlation between like societal, you know, I don't know, impacts, right? So like, you know, financial impacts, material impacts, right? You know, add some Marxism to that thought, or you can also start saying straight up, just, you know, especially when it comes to much more alt-right kind of stuff, ideological reasons. Like, we shouldn't we shouldn't reduce ideological reasons to whatever underlying material reasons there are. That's what people do with like 9/11. Mm-hmm. Like they say, oh man, those people who hijacked the plane, oh they were poor or whatever. No, they were upper middle class. They were fine. They were not. They didn't have material reasons. They were ideologically
American psycho.
Driven. Right. So it's like with these shooters nowadays, it's like, one, they're either impacted by society in material ways, and I don't know the statistics as like, you know, what's, are they more ideological, are they more material, whatever. But like, if it's really the case that they're not, you know, shooting because of mental health reasons, if you have these two cases, they're either going to be ideological, which is insane, and you need to fight that in its own ways, or mental conditions. You know, you know, whatever happens to them, they lose a job. I don't know. Something happens.
And this is how the word unpredictable came about.
It was unpredictable, but you can have in a certain way some preventative measures on a larger macro scale. You know, like
I think it has to. I don't think it has to do with like math or psychological. Or like maybe it does to a certain extent. You know, the main thing and the commonality between all of them is like problems at home. And what they're into, like, what's his fucking name? Jeffrey Dahmer or whatever. Like, his dad was a scientist or whatever and had, like, acid to, like, burn things down. And he was, like, burning, or not burning, but, like, you know what I mean? Get rid of the body structure of fucking...
Decompose.
Yeah, decomposing animals to their bones because he was satisfied with bones. Yeah. But also at the same time, his parents are going through a divorce. His mom is mentally unstable.
Yeah.
His dad is distant and not around that much. And he doesn't have any friends. And he's obsessed with this thing. And then he gets, like, bones. And he's so satisfied with them. He's like, oh, I've killed squirrels and foxes and all the things. Now I need to see human bones.
Mm-hmm. So
gets a car, graduates high school. Like, it has a lot to do with people's like upbringing.
So you're saying it's their adverse childhood experiences.
Yeah. And like whether they get enough attention or not. And like not even just childhood experiences, but just like having friends, having someone to lean on without your own thoughts all the time, you know?
Right. Yeah.
And it also depends on, like, if you're into fucking killing animals and shit at a young age, too. I feel like that also has it's a factor.
Yeah, that's one of the, I think they call it the dark triad of Machiavellian traits.
Yeah, it's like one of the most common things for serial killers. They're like killing shit at a young age.
Yeah.
Well at that point, so you're left with a couple of options. You either have these guys being, you know, like for example, so either they have like some, you know, mental health problem. That's not the case. Okay, what's next? So like, most of the time, what I'm gonna put my money on is some sort of larger societal thing that's dependent on something that we as a society can do. So, for example, like let's say this is very hypothetical. Let's say some kid is going through something and it's affected by a divorce from their parents. Let's say why are their parents going to divorce? Maybe they're having money problems, right? So
it's usually not the case. They just hate their partner.
Well, or that, but see that's also another.
Or despise them.
Why do they hate their partner?
Exactly,
because they're not happy. They're not satisfied. They want to move on.
Why are they not satisfied?
Why? But see, there's two different aspects of this.
They're not getting to do what they want to do, or they're not.
But there are reasons for that.
Yeah, exactly.
But there you go. Let's say
there's
the whole
trial
thing
and error. I'm not saying that it's right.
Let's say the two partners
what
are so busy with their work lives, they don't have they can't interact with each other.
They can't make the money.
What they signed up for is not what they're getting, essentially. So then they
I'm not discrediting like there might be internal reasons that might not or might have little to no connection with the society or whatever. Those reasons might progress things as well. Yeah. But to a certain extent, the furthest we can do as a society is to at least help the material factors to as far as we can.
Yeah.
Right. And that's the whole thing with like, you know, with Marx's theory really is how can we get to a point where we can actually sort of like be happy and pursue what we want. Right.
Yeah, exactly.
You know, like and money and jobs and all that stuff is a big part of that. It's like, you know, you start to grow and resent your partner because all this other stuff gets in the way. And like you start having these thoughts about them that have
you displace your anger from your job or your life situation onto the people that, you know, you care about the most or
whatever. But that's what I'm talking about. It's like not even about those people. It's about the if they have kids together.
Yeah.
They're so fixated on the idea of all of those things that you just said. Yeah. They're leaving the kid is like essentially
they're creating a new problem in that
for
kid's
that
IQ.
Kid. But it's not.
Yeah.
Like
sometimes then.
I mean, sometimes you can literally draw roadmaps. Like literally, father, mother hate each other because of financial problems. Let's say the father gets super mad or whatever.
After the fact, after the kid becomes a suicide fucking killer.
Right, but
that's the only time people start paying attention to them.
Right, but this is what sucks. Let's say like the father gets like, you know, he gets more aggressive because he has financial problems. He doesn't have a wife that loves him anymore. Yeah. Boom, the kid starts getting beat up. Boom, the kid is now like quiet and afraid. Boom, he doesn't talk in school. Boom, he's alone. Boom, when he's alone, he starts having bad thoughts.
And it doesn't always turn into the person becoming a spree killer. Right. But then you have other more real, more, this is what I'm talking about. This is what the media does, is what we're doing right now, we're focusing on spree killers as if they are literally in every corner of our world.
No, they're not.
The real problem is alcohol dependency, domestic violence, rape, you know, and
things that are much more common.
Much, much more common and have just as much of an impact in the long term in terms of societal effects, not so much. I'm not putting down any lives that have been lost at the hand of active shooters or anything.
Yeah, yeah.
But I mean, DV is a serious thing, especially where we are.
Yeah.
There's a lot of domestic violence.
There's crazy fucking people out here.
Yeah. I mean, Alaska, I mean, like, that's the highest case of a lot of stuff.
I want to take a break, but then I want to kind of go back to this. And you and I were talking about this earlier. And talk about the hyper real nature of true crime, and I have one other statement to make on the media that ties into our conversation here. Uh-huh. We should take a short break.
Yeah, I have one more thing. Yeah.
All right, we'll be right back.
All right, that's tonight.
Our thoughts tonight. We are back.
Back.
What's up, son?
So, what I was gonna say was, it's funny when you see things like the Gabby Petito case. What happened this week? I don't know exactly detail for detail because I didn't actively pay attention to it, but I did get a bunch of notifications on my phone from CNN saying, you know, she was missing, and then her body was identified by the Federal Bureau, and then. After that her boyfriend has a warrant out for her arrest, and she was somebody that was thought to be missing and was killed, obviously. Yeah. And they believe it's her boyfriend, though they don't have any evidence, I don't believe, yet. But he's missing. He's on the run, I believe. Anyway, so what I see was CNN talking about this actively.
Mm-hmm.
And then I go on CNN, and they have a spokesperson talking about how media overrepresents white women when they go missing. So I think this theory is called the white missing white woman syndrome. I'll let you go look into that on your own time. But that's essentially what it is. It's when a white woman goes missing, the media talks about it a lot more frequently than if a black person or a indigenous Native American culture person goes missing. And that seems to be very true. Mm-hmm. But the funny thing was, I was literally getting alerts from the CNN app on my phone about this Gabby girl, which is very unfortunate. This is not taking away from that. It's awful, in fact. But at the same time, CNN was talking about how too many people talk about, you know, white women in the media. And then they were criticizing other media sources. CNN was criticizing other media sources about, you know, the missing white woman syndrome when they themselves were actively doing it.
Oh my god, that's so bad on so many different levels.
And this happens all the time. Like, you see this banter back and forth between Fox and CNN,
right?
And they're criticizing the other of being wrongful in many other ways, in many different ways, whether it's the facts they're reporting, the narratives they're reporting, when they're both equally just
but you know what's going on, correct? Because they're stating that they're not like that in essence, which is in its own way like perpetuating this whole fake scenario. Mm-hmm. It's like, oh, we're not like that. We don't do that, even though we're doing that.
We're not like them, even though we're a news reporter.
But which ultimately basically validates them. What they're doing. Like, oh, we don't do white women's syndrome, but we're actually doing it, but we say we're not.
So we're not.
What we're doing is okay.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. We are aware of that what we are doing is wrong.
Yeah, yeah, it's insane. Like, wow. That's,
we're just going to give you some quick verbal justification of why we're doing what we're doing.
And then, oh my God.
That's a fucking podcast title for anyone out there. Why we're doing what we're doing.
It is.
Why we're doing.
It's what? Bailey's
WWD,
podcast.
WWD.
Oh, really?
Why we were doing what we were doing.
I was going to say that.
WWD, yeah.
That's genius. Your wife's a genius.
Yeah, it's insane, though. It's God, it's like, it's validating their own sin.
That's so funny. It completely spaced
my mind. It must have been subliminal.
Yeah.
It was like subconsciously in my mind. I didn't mean that. Shout out. The wad pod.
The other thing is very hyper real and it was tough for me to grasp was the fact that, you know, I started off making true crime videos on YouTube.
Yeah.
And, you know, it was fun and I like true crime and I've always liked true crime to some extent, but when you start to make something, you start to see the emptiness behind it, you know?
Yeah.
And I was like, you know, I was having this existential crisis about all of these cases I was doing. I was like, why am I reporting this? You know, why am I doing this? Mm-hmm. It's not really anything. You know, it's a footnote in the strand of history that, you know, doesn't really matter. It's sensational.
Right. Yeah.
When I really want to be looking at the struggle between power and the forces that fight against it and things like that that interest me. But when I started making videos about things that I wanted to do more, not very many people watched them. And then I literally polled my audience on why they watch YouTube videos. And I'm going to pull it up right now I'll tell you the answers. And it was kind of really hard to see that a lot of them answered in this specific way because in my eyes, it just completely validated the fact that, I mean, even in the digital world, YouTube in this case, people just consume things as much as they can get down. And the question I asked was, which one of the following best describes your reason for watching your favorite YouTube creators? Mm-hmm. As a way to stay up to date with the world, ambiance, to procrastinate, I don't know, I just watch, or to show conscious support for creators. I don't know if you see these, but do you know which one got the most?
Well, you told me.
I don't know, yeah. I just watch.
Yeah, I don't know, I just watch.
That was just a guess.
Was literally
I voted on that. I was one
oh, I'm sorry, ambiance, which is essentially just turning it on and having it as background.
So autopilot.
Wait, was autopilot. That one? Was ambiance the one?
Ambiance was at 29%.
That's essentially...
I don't know, I just watch was 27%. That means over half are people that are not paying attention actively. They're just consuming it.
I voted on that.
You did? Which one did you say?
I think I chose the first one. I don't
know. As a way to stay up to date with the world. Yeah. See, that's totally understandable. Yeah. And the other ones are too. I'm not judging.
Right.
Because
no, I saw that shit because it pops up in my YouTube.
Oh.
Yeah.
Because I follow you and stuff. Mm-hmm. You know.
They're fun to vote on.
I see the videos before they even come out, son. You know? But like, I like hearing about it, you know, and I like listening to it, and it is a way to stay up with the world, but it amazed me. It amazes me that it's ambiance or fucking...
Yeah.
I think... like, I'm just here to listen to background noise, essentially. Yeah. You know what I mean? Like, and then, you know what that does?
It's angering.
Yeah, and to be the creator of that...
No, I could literally just go on there and shit out of my mouth, and people would still listen to it, apparently, if I put a good thumbnail on
it. It's equal to the news that we get today.
Yeah, you're right. Yeah, very good point.
That's a big thing, though. So it's like, the second one isn't... Like, I think it could be interpreted in different ways. Like, oh, I don't know, just watch. That can mean a lot of different things. But, like, ambience being number one is, like, is very different. You know?
Yeah,
it's like the feel of it. It's not the... It's not literally...
Yeah, that
is...
But when
it's
you have...
the feel of it.
When you have ambience as one, and I don't know, I just watched as number two.
Yeah. But the thing is,
you know, they didn't just want to hit ambience or like, dude, I don't know, I just watch.
Like, dude, I mean,
it's the same thing.
There is, I wish I took the aesthetics class as being at UAE right now. But aesthetics has become such a big thing. Because honestly, like, dude, your videos does have an aesthetic. That's not where the true value lies, but it does have an aesthetic.
Yeah.
That's why people watch it, you know? And apparently, according to at least 29%. So it's like, where are we? like, because aesthetics at the end of the day is just representation.
It has nothing to do with content.
It's just representation.
It's the feeling that these people are getting, and that's fine too. I mean, there is no right or wrong way to do anything. Course, but like, to the creator, it's kind of like a slap in the face.
Yeah.
Like, you take all the time to source this information. You make sure all the information is accurate to the history books and everything. You find the music. You find the hardest part.
You fucking spend 2 months making the fucking video. For people to have it,
and they listen to it.
Can you
read ambiance?
Yeah,
bitch. We're talking about ambiance.
I'm about to slap you with a bike. So.
Can you read the other percentages for the other things?
Oh yeah,
hit that shit.
Black Swan. The other percentages as a way to stay up to date with the world: 16%.
Okay.
Ambiance: 29%. To procrastinate: 16%. I don't know. I just watch: 27%. To show conscious support for creators, 13%, which is the one that should be the fucking highest.
Yeah,
because this doesn't just exist on YouTube. Yeah. It's literally crafted by every single person on there. Yeah. Some more than others. And if you watch my video, I can guarantee you I craft them much more than most YouTubers out there. And that doesn't... I'm not entitled to any viewership or anything. But, you know... My hope is, like, when somebody watches that, they say, oh, there's some cool story going on and some cool music and visuals. Even if you're not into the story completely, like, maybe it's not your topic of choice.
It's equal to a Netflix documentary.
It's well made. That's like,
well, thanks. Yeah, I appreciate that. But, like, you know, you would see that and be like, you know, I don't really understand what he's saying, but the visuals make sense.
Right,
you know, you could just literally watch the pictures go by, you would understand the story, and the music sounds good.
Yeah.
Even if you don't understand all the lingo, that should be enough, and that's my goal.
I mean, isn't that weird?
I read a book, but it's like a picture book with like two sentences on each page.
But it's the best of both worlds.
You know what I mean?
Isn't that a little bit of ambience, though? So, like, that's what I'm saying. Like, I wonder about how people are interpreting this. Like, for example, like, one option that's not on there that connects with other options, like, to learn something, right?
Yeah.
Because that can connect with staying
people
up to date.
People have said that on the comments, too.
Right. So, like, that can connect with to stay up to date because you're learning something. That could connect with, I don't know, I just watch it. That's also connect with learning. So, it's like, I don't really know.
People are indecisive.
It is a little hard to gather all of that.
I mean,
I tried to actually spend some time wording these out so that they encompassed a lot of
At the end of the day, ambience won, you know, and very clearly won.
Yeah.
So it's like, well, that says something, you know?
You know what? It could be a good thing. Maybe they're just like hearing your fucking voice.
It's not a bad thing. Yeah.
It's
ambience. They're like, I like hearing Alex Trebek's voice.
I mean, hell, that shows you that you don't have to worry so much about research, but you should, you know, obviously for your own reasons.
Yeah, it's the integrity because there are the people that do pay attention.
Right.
But, this does bring up a point as to what you and I were talking about representation and like semiotics and the hyper real nature of things. And I think the fact that ambiance, like it literally says in parentheses, background noise is the leader in all of that says a lot about like, okay, you could be working, right? Let's say you're working in the dish pit. Yeah. And you're listening to something, and that could count as ambiance, but you're still using that as a way to escape this world because the dish pit is miserable.
Yeah. Right, right.
So why are you listening to that? Because you don't want to actively be here. You want to be in the hyper real.
Uh-huh. Yeah.
And this is the death. The real does not matter to you. So our bodies don't matter to us anymore, realistically.
Yeah. We are robots.
And we are living in a grave,
is somewhere else.
Essentially.
Yeah.
This world, to a lot of people, 27%, or I'm sorry, 29%, and potentially 27%, this world does not exist anymore. Yeah. This world is only getting in the way of the world they want to be in.
Right. Yeah. I mean, that connects with a lot of what Bojar was saying, was like, the reason why we're in this hyper-real situation is because simulation is euphoric.
Yeah.
You know, it's by an essence euphoric. And like, I'm actually going to tie this a little bit with the romantic movement, and like, you know a lot more about that than me, so back me up on this, but it's like, for example, the Romantic movement is described, or at least contained within the ideas of like pure emotion, right? What is most accessible, or what brings about the most pure, most authentic emotion or whatever within the art, as opposed to like more like contentful classical stuff, right? And that connects with this in a certain way, where it's like we're more concerned about like are the feelings of stuff, uh-huh. and you know what, how does it make us feel? Because at the end of the day,
techno romanticism.
And exactly, that's a great term, right? And like, I mean, even consider this idea, which is technically a much more, it connects with like therapy and stuff. But like, you can't control what things can do, but you can control how you react mm-hmm. to things,
interpret it,
right? And that's a healthy therapeutic thing, but that connected with everything else is like we can't control the content of the world or whatever. No. Or at least the work to control it is so long.
That goes with anything. And
but
everything.
Now we have to feel it.
You can make food for people, and they may not give you the reaction that you're wanting them to give. Mm-hmm. You know, or you can make music. You know, yeah. And there's a handful of people that fucking love it, and then the rest of them hate it.
Right.
You can make a piece of art. It's the same thing. It's subjective, dude.
Well, I'm really glad you mentioned subjectivity, because at the end of the day, I think this is the reality of, you know, coming from philosophy, the reality of how important idealism, subjectivity are, because at the end of the day, we have the complete right to throw away the world and just seclude ourselves in our own minds. We have that freedom.
Yeah.
And doing that has established hyper reality.
But when you give a lot of shits about what you're doing and what you're creating for people and for the content or for whatever, and then, like, you don't get the answers that you want, it's kind of like a fucking punch in the gut.
Yeah, well, that's the thing. Like
unwarranted. You're like, oh, I'm going to go.
I mean, if you're engaging with the
trash,
if you're engaging with the world in the way where it's your somewhat in access to reality, yeah. That's great. But for the majority of the people, that's not what's happening to them. Yeah. They're in the hyper reality, right?
Yeah.
Cyberpunk
2020. Yeah, 2022. Yeah.
You know, I personally, for the most part, the social psychology textbooks will say, like, you know, there's also the cognition issue. You know, some people are incapable of reading through a message, whether it's on the news or, you know, my videos or, you know, ContraPoints videos or whoever right. you want to watch. They just watch them and absorb them mm-hmm. because the cognition is not there. But if you're actually like actively in criticism of media, mm-hmm. watch even your favorite YouTubers or Netflix documentaries with a critical eye mm-hmm. because you realize especially that mediums are incredibly subjective. There mm-hmm. is no, when you break it down, it's just images literally being presented at the right time.
Yeah.
And that's all it is. I mean, there it's is nothing more. And but it's being presented on a nice bright pixel with a titanium cover made by some company in California.
But it's pretty crazy because like this entire process of creating these simulations and images is so precise. Like it's the entire there's theory involved as to how you can influence people and how, you know, when to do an image and how to do it or whatever, what stimulates people, whatever. It's so incredibly precise and in the real. Mm-hmm. Like, because I think at the end of the day, hyperreality is fueled by reality, right? But, you know, like, and you as a content creator, you know, you delve into your work and you do things in specific ways because it's just the best way to do it, right? And you go into, like, you know, marketing or something, they market these things in different ways because that's what's going to stimulate people the most. And that's the crazy, because at the end of the day, hyper reality in itself is so fixated on the grudges of people who are doing the real work, who are actually engaging in that stuff, all to present this very much euphoric picture of whatever. But obviously for the 90% of the people out there, it's they just consume that. And really what sucks about it is when people start to quote unquote wake up, and that's such a weird way to say it, but like once they say, okay, let me do that. Let me do what they do. And they get confronted with what they actually have to do. It's like, then it's like too much. Oh, wow. I want to be, for example, they might start out as a kid saying, I love these movies, blah, blah. And they grew up, oh, I love these movies anymore. Let me see which directors are like, blah, 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 blah. Let's see. They try to actually go into that.
You see the
field.
Mess involved.
I mean, like, for example, like I'll give it a personal example with philosophy. I went to philosophy thinking, oh, these are what I'm interested in, you know, existential questions, whatever. You know, I like some Nietzsche here.
Let's learn about Nietzsche and Socrates.
Like, and then like I go into this and it's much, much, much more thorough than I thought it would be. Like,
I'll meet you on the court, bitch.
And it gets consistently more complex. Yeah, just
the
like
more
a year
you read, it just opens up another reality yeah. that you have to figure
and the thing
out.
Is, and obviously for some people that they like that. They like the rigor of it. And I do. I do like going and considering synthetic a priori judgments and references and ontology and stuff like that. I do like that. But it can be overwhelming because it is overwhelming, especially when it's presented in such a euphoric way. So it's hyperreality at the end of the day is going. I guess it's a prediction. Hyperreality is going to a spot where people are just going to be like, at the end of the day, I don't really care. You know, I'll just go do my, you know, 9 to 5 and just engage in, you know, some
random
movie.
Until I can go into hyperreality.
Yeah, just,
right?
And because it is euphoric, they're not going to, you know, engage thoroughly. And it's, no one can blame them. You know, it's really in human nature to really engage with that stuff.
Yeah.
Like, for example, like, I was thinking about this the other day. It's like, it's not in human functions to go towards the harder thing or to go like do something
you're
that's
drawn to the sweet fruit.
Exactly. So it's like it's almost inevitable that it's going to be, you know, even more hyperreal than it already is, really.
I want you, we're going to switch the subject now. I want you to talk about that war shit you were talking about earlier.
Oh,
hold on. Well, we should. Let's finish this real quick and then take a break.
Okay. We should go back to the hyper reality, but I will talk about that. Yeah.
Okay. I'll tell what you was one. I going to say? Damn it.
Sorry. I'm
It up. Okay. There is increasingly less and less.
What the fuck?
Sweat?
Hyperreal.
Sean.
Sean in ghost form throwing bottles down.
No, he's probably
he can't
like,
read his poem.
You fucking postmoderns.
Yeah. Old head science.
Yeah.
Yeah, there's increasingly less and less of a reason to want to actually pay attention to the real and want to go into hyperreal.
Yeah.
I hate my job. I hate the people here. Yeah. Not the people I work with. But I hate the people that are involved, that I have to deal with.
Day to day.
I hate the people I see on the street. I don't like the way they don't question largely. I mean, there are individuals here and there.
Yeah.
Those are footnotes.
Yeah.
but largely, like, people are the type of people that will consume true crime or watch CNN and don't realize that the CIA is controlling a lot of that.
Yeah.
And they don't question it. And honestly, I don't really care to talk to those people or be even associated largely. I just kind of like would rather go into the hyper reality where the algorithm will just patch me in with the homeboy that, like, you know, questions, you know, old head science the same ways I do. And like, it's like, hey, you like postmodernism? Here's a couple of videos that'll enlighten you.
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah, it's crazy because even
common interest,
even intellectualism has to a certain sense been hyper realized to a certain extent.
It's nice to produce content and finding someone that has the same views as you, whether they be good or bad in whatever subject, you know what I mean? Like, it's nice to know that there's people out there that view the same shit you do the same way to a certain extent, you know? And then they're like, oh, not only do I agree with you, but here's some shit I'm going to give to you that I saw that you might have not saw. And chances are that you didn't see them. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
That's crazy in itself.
Yeah, yeah.
And
then you get to see even more.
Yeah, and you get it's like a chain effect. You fucking fall into the rabbit hole, eating it all up. But the craziest part about it is that you haven't actually met this person, like, face to face, right? They're just a person on the internet that has the same views as you.
In fact, you probably will never meet them.
And you probably never will meet them. This person that's a figment of my imagination, essentially. I don't even know what they look like. Uh-huh. They agree and have the same views as me. But I rather agree with this person I barely even know that has the same views as me, like, depending on the subject, instead of talking to some fucking schmo on the side of the road that I can see, like, that has no fucking clue, you know, about what's going on. It has, like, no sense of awareness or anything. You know what I mean?
Yeah. And I was going to say something, but I completely forgot. But to play off that, though, is like what Baudrillard would probably say is like, well, to you, that person isn't really a person. That person is just a
figment of your imagination.
Well, kind of like a system of ideas. A person is just is being represented through their quote-unquote ideas, and at the end of the day, if you agree with them, they're really just a mirror off yourself.
That's very Freudian, and I think he pulls
also Hegelian,
that from Freud
maybe
because And this is a lot of the reason as to why I don't show my face in my videos, among other reasons. But a good reason is because when you hear my voice or when you hear a different creator's voice, you're not picturing me. You don't know, because if you could actually physically, materially picture me, you could be like, your eyes stupid or your hair color is dumb or
I'm Alfred Hitchcock.
Yeah, you could literally point at something and be like, I don't like him because. But if the people are like, I don't like that guy, why don't I like him outside of my voice is, you know, just projection, you know, your own reasons outside of my ideas as well. And to some extent, like if you say something totally uncontroversial and people find a reason to really get upset with you, like that one Nietzsche video we did, like that guy was just angry.
Right. Right.
And he didn't like whoever he thought I was. And realistically, probably doesn't like himself, it seems, because he's really thinking in really bad ways about who is behind that voice.
Right. And although so in a way, you know, I guess I'm going to put a position and then go against it, is like to hide your face and to do whatever to impersonalize it is to completely fabricate what you're presenting through ideas, right? To be authentic, but in a way that in itself has its own problems, because for example, when you do that, you're presenting a presentation of objectification, right? So they can, so people can disagree with you solely based off those ideas. They're not going to disagree with you because they don't like your face or whatever, right? They're attacking you and your ideas, right? But at the same time, for some people, because you're really in a position of authority, not authority, but like you're, it's a facade, or not facade, there's a vibe.
It's
really
your stage.
Yeah, it's your stage, right? So you're coming off in a presentation of objectivity. But that really, but you aren't though, because we all have our biases and whatnot. We all have, you know, there is no one that's purely objective. So whatever. So it's like, it's weird to even, you can't escape that. So I'm getting that mostly from conversations I've had with class, so like with religion, like even the objective views on religion are based off subjective biases. So when you're presenting something in objective ways, you're really hiding your subjectivity, which is the reality of the situation, right? But then again, if you present yourself, then you have all these other problems. Like they will go against, you know, your face. So really at the end of the day, you only have a very, very minute percentage of people who will look at you for your ideas and also still see your subjective views. So it's incredibly complex and difficult, because you really, one, you can't ever escape the subjectivity, and if you do, you're presenting a hyper real situation, which in itself is also problematic. So it's like it's very much inevitable with all these problems going on.
It says I was just reading the other day, I agree with you on that, but also a phenomenon that we're seeing now is people are more honest on social media than they are in real life.
That's true too.
So that is a big problem, I think, and that adds to the fact, or that adds to the reasons as to why people are becoming even more hinged onto things like social media or YouTube, or, well, technically Instagram. YouTube is, but Instagram, anything hyper real in that sense, because they can actually be themselves on there now, and in fact present themselves in a more controlled way, so they have more control over this reality. And as we grow these mental scars in the real world, we are one of the first few things we want to do is control our environment. So if you can completely control the way you're perceived, why wouldn't you want to constantly? That like you said, is something that humans are drawn towards.
Right.
Right. So, I mean, we've got a big problem coming our way, and I think we can bring up Kaczynski.
Yeah. Well, I was actually going to tie it with something. Well, I was actually going to expand the ideas, like, because now we're creating not only, you know, various products that are hyper real. By the way, just randomly, I'm drinking Calypso Triple Lemon Lemonade, and
Triple Lemonade.
So the way ingredients work is the first ingredient is always the most. So you have filtered water. You have filtered water first, then sugar, then lemon juice concentrate. So lemon juice.
Even lemon juice.
Yeah, yeah. So it's very much hyper real. But what I'm trying to say
hyper
is like
real.
Right. So it's like it's not only just products of society, but we've gotten to a point where we're constructing individuals, right? Which is, I mean, if you're gonna ask me what is like the quintessential theme of the modern day,
it's what's the quintessential theme of the modern day?
The individual, right? but in much more complex way, like we're, you know, we're going beyond, like we're nihilistic. We're all these different things. We have, in a way, total control of the representation of ourselves. And it's, we haven't really ever experienced that. You know, we started out as like the villager, and everyone knows you can't control how you view yourself.
Hey, man, help me with this. Hey,
right, and then it's going as okay, you have like roads to better yourself. Oh, I'll go and be a soldier, whatever, World War One. But now it's like it doesn't matter anymore. It's just how you present yourself, and it's so insane because at that point we're almost like having different personalities, and it's in ways that are much more explicit, which is. It's so dangerous. It's just
hyper
so dangerous.
Real, dude.
It's hyper real. We're hyper real simulations of ourselves to ourselves.
Yeah, yeah. Because we believe a lot.
We believe that
see.
Exactly. Yeah.
And we can't discern.
Yeah.
From one to another.
All right, let's take a break, guys.
All right, yeah. I did have one thing to say before okay. we do.
Sorry.
Yeah. I was forgetting it. God damn it! Damn it!
Second.
I've had too much wine to remember what I said, but.
What was I gonna say? Oh yeah, one thing that I really, really like that Baudrillard says, if I'm not mistaken, I'm pretty sure it was Baudrillard, and it has to do with semiotics, and just I don't even remember what it's from, but something along the lines of, you know, a lot of the purpose in our lives seems to revolve around the fact that we're trying to confirm our existence
yeah.
through other means, not from
Agreed.
Ourselves. Because we can't actually confirm our own existence, contrary to the, you know, Descartes.
I don't even think it's just that. I think it's having meaning of our existence and approval of
that's
others.
That's what Niles accept, yeah.
But we have to first acknowledge the fact that we do exist. So let's say like when somebody's completely distraught, they go to somebody like a hotline or they go to their friend or they go to their mom or their dad or whoever, you know, they come
Whoever's
with their
closest.
Problem. Yeah. You come with your problem and you spill. And what most people do is they give advice, which is awful. You're not supposed to do that. I mean, that's our inclination as the person. That's the person that's perceiving.
I'll tell you
it
what I would do.
We don't like to see people struggling because that means something is wrong, and you know. So that's why people.
Human empathy.
Let me show you a light to the end of your tunnel.
What you're supposed to do is obviously validate.
Right.
Like, affirm. Your problem is legit.
Mm-hmm.
And that's like, oh, you know, and the person snaps into it suddenly and they're like, okay, I exist. It's not just a perception error. And Baudrillard says, we see this in many different ways. That's a really extreme form of it. But you see this in other different ways. And one way you see it is graffiti artists.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Graffiti artists like
Banksy.
I don't know who that is.
Banksy's an artist that's in like London and shit.
The guy that nobody knows who he is.
Yeah, they don't know what his
Hyper
face
real
is.
Hyper-real shout-out. Yeah.
That's crazy.
He does crazy shit, and it sells for like millions of dollars.
Really?
Yeah. Go ahead.
Wait, how do they sell it if it's
he just
graffiti?
He like, puts it up. Like, not just graffiti. He does like
who sells
art
it?
Print, too. He does, but they don't know what he looks like.
I'm sure somebody does.
Someone's
like got
to know what he looks like.
Hyper real situation. He's a product
there was
of his
this
own
Mr.
product.
Mr. Brainwash or whatever that fucking like interviewed him and stole his style and like literally just like makes prints of things and like.
But you could do it and show up somewhere and be like, "Hey, I'm this guy."
Yeah, but he's like an actual fucking artist. Like,
but how would anybody know?
He's a freehand artist. So.
But what if he changed
his style?
He doesn't change his
style.
Like,
what makes him confirm? Like, does he have like a business license that he like? He shows his license, like,
this
you don't know who I am, but here it is.
This guy is like a prime artist. I'm sorry to change this up on you guys.
Yeah, but if he did
change his
style,
like one of his
pieces. How would anybody know it's really him?
It is him.
So he's condemned to being that one personality.
Yeah, I guess. But like, here's an example. Like, he likes to pull pranks on people, right? So like, he puts this piece of art. It's like this girl holding a balloon, right? In a frame. But it's a frame that he conducted himself, that he made himself. Right? This frame is a fucking paper shredder.
Okay.
So while they're in the middle of auctioning off this fucking...
He shreds it halfway.
Mm.
He shreds it halfway. In the middle of it, no one knows anything about it. Like, this guy is a pimp,
That's
dude.
Pretty good.
Because he fucking shredded it halfway, had control of the machinery that he made the frame of, and then it was like at 2 million or something like that. And then the fucking price went up like 6 million or some shit.
What's his name?
I'm not even joking. Banksy. And I was just like, dude, this guy is just like the best artist
That's
ever.
Awesome.
Because he likes to fuck with people. He's like, dude, I don't even think my art's worth that much. You know?
Yeah.
Like, there's documentaries.
No, he understands that. And that's a huge thing that Baudrillard
You know what I mean? He's like,
too.
It's just art. He's like, it's just me conveying
it's
myself.
It's a representation.
Yeah, and all these people are like, oh, it's this much, it's this much. He's like, I'm going to prove a point. It makes a frame like that. So it shreds half of his art. And people are freaking out. All that shit. And he's just like laughing because he's the one that pressed the button.
That is so hyper real.
You know what I mean? Like that shit is cool. I love people like that. That's like Joey Feldman. He's a great artist too, but he's not like on the same level as Banksy to me.
Yeah, no, that is some serious shit.
That's weird.
But so before I forget again,
sorry.
So the people like Banksy, like the graffiti artists, they do that in his eyes through that. What he thinks, like through semiotics, as a semiotic belief or whatever, is that it's them like saying, look at me, I exist. Yeah. Here is this. You know, I did that. That's me. And same with any artist, realistically. Uh-huh. Like that's, I'm leaving that little bit of my perception there.
Here's like, a piece of puzzle of me
on the wall right there by Nick. And it's a painting of a mountain. And
Bob Ross,
he's like, I'm just leaving this little square of my perception of this mountain there.
Uh-huh.
And that's me kind of validating my own experience to the best of my ability.
Right. See, the thing is, that whole idea is incredibly, and I'm going to be honest, that's incredibly Hegelian and also Fichtean, is the whole idea of you affirm your own, because you mentioned earlier on, like it's very anti-Descartes, right? The whole idea is you affirm your existence through other people's existence, right?
I truly believe that.
Yeah, and it's huge. It's a huge concept. That's what goes into, and if you really want to explain the whole idea, if you really want to expand the whole idea, that's the whole idea of realizing your self-consciousness through other people's consciousness, whatever. It's a big part of that goes to master-slave dialectics. It goes into Marx, how like, you know, people are ultimately, you know, as is like, you know, proletariat, quote unquote, are affirmed in our interaction with bourgeoisie, blah, 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 blah. Mm-hmm. But in our situations where, you know, you make the art as a sort of, you know, I guess you could say interaction with other people to affirm that you're really here. You know, they see what you've done and they see that you are a person, right? But also, like, I feel like in a way we can...
Not just see who you are as a person, but like what you can do.
Well, what you can do is a part of...
What you're capable of.
But that's a good point, because then what we become is not who we are.
You still have to first realize that you are. You're
verifying that you exist.
But then what are you actually affirming that you exist? Are you actually saying that you exist? Are you saying that, but also I'm a product of my products. I am what my products are. I am not who I am. No. I am just my material representations.
Or it could be you are buying a piece of me and what I believe and what I'm about.
Right. But for example, but there's a disconnect. For example, I can pump out music 24/7 and mean all these things, but there is more to me than that. There's more to me than the art. There's more to me than work.
I know you're hitting the synth when you're drunk. Calm down.
No, but that's joking. What I'm saying, though, is like we become a product of our own products, right?
Yeah, yeah.
And even when, but that's when we can create, but how about when we consume? Even when we consume, we're... in a way, validating our own things.
Trying to validate our own experience.
Yeah, because we consume what we like. Because the intensity is a real thing in the world.
Frank Sinatra.
I'm validating my
ideas.
This
kind of goes really well with like Bailey's new newsletter. I know you mentioned Wad One earlier, but she says, she quotes this psychiatrist. Let me grab the paper real quick.
Oh, there you go.
And I don't want to read the whole quote because it's really long. So yeah, he argues
again, actually, because I was looking. Actually, let me just read it myself.
He argues that the brain is a consciousness factory, essentially. Yeah. It's taking things in.
As it's taking things in, you're giving yourself reasons to have permission to take these things in.
Yeah.
Right.
Oh, this is.
I think probably. I don't know what he says exactly.
That's how I interpreted it.
There's a lot of, I think, context needed for this, because when he says, indeed, I think consciousness is not produced by the brain. Oh, so you know, he's against the idea of it being a little fact, because he says, I think consciousness is not produced by the brain, in parentheses, as if it's a little factory turning it out in a good sort of corporate way. So he's actually against the idea that consciousness is from the brain.
No, I think it's like a mirror or a lens or something, if I'm not...
Well, I mean, I think a lot of context is needed, because when he says, and indeed, I think consciousness is not produced by the brain, parentheses, you don't really know
Let's
things.
Let's call her. We'll be right back, and we're going to call Bailey, and she'll answer this question for us. We're back on Our Thoughts Tonight, and we're asking Bailey if she can give us some context. So what was the question again, Ashok?
Okay, so I'm just going to read the first quote, first paragraph, whatever.
Yeah, sure.
Because he says, and indeed, I think consciousness is not produced by the brain, parentheses, as if it's this little factory turning out in this sort of way. So he doesn't think it's a little factory turning it out in a good sort of corporate way. Or is he? Is that right?
Yeah, that's right. I think the way he describes it, he goes on to say something about how, based on the way he conceptualizes it, he thinks that the brain permits consciousness as opposed to churning it out. I think what he says.
Oh, okay.
That
makes sense.
That's what I thought, because when he says there aren't things for you to know, it's basically, it's actually very it's actually very anti phenomenologist, anti the phenomenologist approach, because, like, for example, they would say, like, oh, it's actually a sense of intentionality, consciousness must be conscious of something to be consciousness. But when he says there aren't things for you to know, it's not saying consciousness is determined by contents. It's more like it's its own thing. Mm-hmm. That's what it seems like he's saying there.
Yeah.
Right.
It's and you kind of just decide what you take in or not, or what, to what extent you can.
I think so. And then, you know, and I think consciousness is not produced by the brain. So the brain, and then later on, I think it says a primitive experience. So it's more like, it's what I, the way I'm seeing it is a brain is just a sort of tool to, I suppose, take in these contents, but not that consciousness it is in itself dictated by those contents. Does that make any sense?
Yeah, I think you're putting good words to it. I definitely am not a professional, or, like, I don't study Ian McGilchrist's perspective or anything. I just have read a bit of his stuff, and I've only heard him talk more than even read him. But I do know that he's a psychiatrist, like, if you just want any background on him. Did you guys already talk about who he is?
We did, briefly, yeah.
Okay. Yeah, I think that what I really admire about him is that he doesn't purport to, you know, thoroughly be able to speak on things outside of psychiatry, but his experience as a psychiatrist really informs the things that he does allow himself to kind of, like, theorize on for fun, and I think what he has to say is really interesting. And apparently he has some friends who are, like, physicists, and I think he has some high-level, like, philosophy students that he speaks to, and he says he bounces his ideas off of them to make sure that he's not completely out of left field, and I just really respect that. And I think he's got some interesting thoughts there. I definitely would not know how to categorize what he says of consciousness, but I definitely just wanted to include that quote in my last newsletter.
Mm-hmm. All right. Well, thanks for answering the call.
Yeah, we're very confused. But
all right.
Yeah.
That was Bailey.
Right. So you had something to say about this, though, right?
Oh, yeah, I guess so. Yeah. I don't even remember, but yeah. I kind of feel that it's some sort of, like, instrument, you know. I don't even know what the context was anymore, but
I don't know. Who am I?
I don't know. It doesn't matter anymore. What were we even talking about? Well, oh, yeah, our existence. Yeah.
Right.
So validating our existence.
Right.
I think because there are so many perceptual errors and just, we're so limited in our understanding of, like, what it's like. We know that there is a lot we don't know inherently. Mm-hmm.
That might be a cause for a lot of this. 'Cause, like, we're trying to inherently be, we're trying to be independent beings in society that's inherently not independent.
Yeah.
You know, it's, you know, and that, you know, that might lead into the break or whatever. It's a paradox.
It is. It really is, honestly. And it's really fucked up to some extent, but whatever. Right. Our thoughts tonight. We'll be right back.
Yeah, with some not so hyper real, but maybe hyper real discussions.
Our thoughts tonight.
Our thoughts tonight.
So Zach, who is rolling silverware across the room, he's still here. Yeah. Wanted to hear Ashok's about Ashok's topic. On our wings are here.
Yeah. Okay,
about Ashok's topic on his research, or what his research paper is about.
Because it's really interesting, and I want to hear about medieval shit.
So we're going to do that, and then we'll give our final thoughts for this episode.
I guess it's such an interesting story that I guess I'll mention it. So this is called the German Thrones Dispute. This is, you know, history thoughts with Ishik. So it, I think, occurred from like the 1190s to the 1210s. It was a dispute for the position of the Holy Roman Emperor, which is Germany, not the Roman Empire, as I was often misunderstood. So basically, you have Henry VI of the Holy Roman Empire dying, and then his wife basically takes their kid Frederick. I think her name is Constance, and she basically goes and takes their kid to Sicily to make him the king of Sicily, a child king, and to basically make him a vassal of the Pope, Pope Innocent III. Why does she do that? Because she wants to be with the Pope. She's infatuated with the Pope. So she basically wants to basically show like this action of like fidelity to the Pope to hopefully get with him. But she dies, and the kid is now a kid king of Sicily, and he's a vassal of the Pope. And now in the Holy Roman Empire, there is no clear line of succession. So the two candidates that eventually come up is Philip of Swabia, which is the brother of the dead king and also the uncle of the kid, and some guy named Otto of Saxony. So Philip is from the Hohenstaufen family, which is the family that was ruling beforehand, and Otto is from the Welfs. And Otto really is brought into position from the king of England, Richard I, who supports him. He's like, Otto should be the king, right? And because I think there were some political connections. And Otto's like, okay, fuck it. I'm going to be the new emperor. And all these guys are supporting me. And then Philip doesn't actually want to be king, but all these other guys are like, well, we can't let Otto be the guy, because if Otto becomes the king, he's going to want my land. So let me support this guy who's the uncle of the right heir to the throne, who's not in Germany right now. So they support Philip. And now that you have this whole thing, okay, who do you support, Philip or Otto? And now the Pope's like, okay, who the hell do I support? And both of them get crowned, but they're both crowned incorrectly. Philip, I think, is crowned in the right place. No. Yeah, he's crowned in... No, he's not crowned the right place. I forget who gets what, but basically one of them gets crowned not in the right place, although there was some other emperors getting crowned in that place. But they have the right material, so they have like the crown, they have the scepter, whatever. And the other person gets crowned the right place, but they have like replicas of the shit. And also, who gets to crown him? Like, I think Philip is not crowned by a proper bishop that's supposed to crown it, but Otto does get crowned by the archbishop, I think, of Cologne. So the Pope is like, well, who do I support? Let me support Otto, because at least he was crowned by the right bishop, right? So that's who he supports. But there's still battles going on. And so, but this is the funny part of the story. There is the whole murder of Philip, right? This is what Zach was so interested about, is there is this guy, and Philip's at this guy's wedding, right? And so this guy is going to marry this girl, but this girl's father is like, wait a minute, this guy is actually kind of insane. He's actually super angry, and he says he's a hothead. I'm worried about my daughter. Let me cancel the marriage. So that's what happens. And then this guy is like, oh my God, what happened? And then he blames Philip II, who was at the wedding, because apparently he cock-blocked him earlier, I think with his sister or some other relative for him. So he's like, oh, it's your fault again. You cock-blocked me the first time. You cock-blocked me now the second time, which you really didn't. And so he kills Philip II.
I'm going to get you.
Right. So at this point, there is only really Otto at the contending for the throne. And the Pope's like, see, I was right. Because the Pope swore to Otto. He's like, see, I was right. He died. So God must show that Philip was wrong, because he died, even though he actually died.
Because Pope's a bitch, and he's just pitching. He's like rooting for whatever side is the most powerful at
right. And there's actually a poem out there talking about how from the time period or something like that, where some guys talk about how corrupt the church is.
And this is where Sean comes in and says, I'm gonna read a poem.
Right. I mean, I want to actually delve into that poem later, but like, anyway, so Otto's the main guy, and then I actually forget the right, and then Otto eventually actually starts going against the Pope. For example, he starts taking back some land that the Pope had, that he actually promised the Pope. And so the Pope's like, well, what the hell do I do now? Now this guy's against me. So eventually what happens is Frederick, the kid who's now grown up, gets into the scene, and everyone's like, and the Pope starts supporting the kid instead. It's like, Frederick, now you should be the king. And eventually Frederick starts winning some battles, and Otto eventually gets killed in a battle with the French in a different war, with the Anglo-French war of 12, 13, 14 or something like that. And then, Otto is killed because he's allied with the English. So he gets, so Otto's killed, and Otto's killed much later because Frederick already basically secures the throne before Otto dies. But at that point, the kid becomes the ruler, and it's like, oh, justice, the kid who was supposed to be the ruler in the first place, but his mom fucked everything up, is back to being king. But pretty interesting.
Should we, yeah. Final thoughts?
Yeah, final thoughts.
Hyperreality is very real. Whether you know it or not.
It's true.
That's a great quote. Hyperreality is very real. Hyperreal is very real.
It's almost like it's hyperreal.
It's like it's our thoughts tonight.
Hell yeah.
So my final thought will be these two hyperreal episodes were great. And I'm sure hyperreality will come up forever more in our podcast. But one day, like maybe a year or two from now, we should revisit this when we're all better read on the subject as well.
Yeah.
I agree with that.
I'm out of context on all degrees. Is this pizza really pizza?
No, I think that's a good idea. And also, like,
wings.
I mean, like, for example, like we started this podcast. Like, you would always mention Freud. I would always mention Kaczynski, right? So now I think the new thing's coming up is hyper-reality for everybody. Because it's the most, and it's just so true.
Inevitably, like, we're going to start noticing it more and more, too.
Oh,
that's
yeah.
the other thing.
It's, and again, I think the more you expand on the concept of hyper-reality, the more prevalent it gets. Because I mentioned the first episode how, like, I think it's much more, it's in everything. It's from agriculture to the idea of working and all these things. But the whole idea of representation. So, yeah, I think we should revisit this later on. I think it's one of those topics that I think we should really always bring it up. And we're going to always bring up.
It's forevermore.
Forevermore, right? I guess final thought is, I guess to tie in, yeah, I guess just to tie in the what I just said with the German thrones dispute and hyperreality, I only know that through online sources, through primary documents and secondary documents. My representation of what really happened in Germany from 1190s to 1210s is through writing.
It could be completely wrong.
It could be completely fake, completely wrong. It never really happened. But to me, it's presented to that. And to me, that's my reality, you know?
It's just a narrative.
It's a narrative. That's actually a lot of what history is. A lot of what history is actually creating narratives. So, again, even things thousands of years ago are, I guess 1,000 years ago for this is through the lens of hyperreality. So what can we do?
Our thoughts.
Our thoughts tonight.
Good night.
Oh, to write a song that has no meaning at all, that doesn't touch a personal nerve or heed a social call, that knows no up or down, that has no right or wrong, that doesn't need a reason to waste some time with song, just like that old time rock and roll with the easy chords and a touch of soul. Give me old time rock and roll, and I'll sing ba-bop, shabop, and whoa, whoa, whoa. Song that doesn't let it all hang out, that doesn't wave any flag or have any slogan to shout, that knows no east or west, that has no left or right, that doesn't throw any stones or look for any fight, just like that old time rock and roll with the easy chords and a touch of soul. Give me old time rock and roll, and I sing ba-bop, shabop, and whoa, whoa, whoa. Just to write a song that won't mend a broken heart, that won't woo you like a lover or promise a brand new start, that doesn't preach of rain and fire or heed any higher call, that doesn't need a reason to mean nothing at all, just like that old time rock and roll with the easy chords and a touch of soul. Give me old time rock and roll, and I sing ba-bop, shabop, and whoa, whoa, whoa. Just like that old time rock and roll with the easy chords and a touch of soul. Give me old time rock and roll, and I sing ba-bop, shabop, and whoa, whoa, whoa. Ba-bop, shabop, and whoa.
bop, shabop, and whoa, whoa, whoa.